Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. Surprisingly enough, food and drink have been consumed in the air since the second manned flight of a balloon on December 1st, 1783. On that occasion, physicist Jacques Charles handed his companion a glass just before the ropes were released, and as the balloon soared into the air, he theatrically popped the cork on a bottle of champagne, poured himself and his companion a glass, and they toasted the crowd. Since then, an amazing variety of delectables have been consumed aloft, and the shifts in eating patterns aloft mirrors the history of air travel itself. As many of us are making our plans for summer travel, it seems appropriate then to talk with today's guest, Richard Foss. He's the author of Food in the Air and Space, The Surprising of History and of Food and Drink in the Skies. It is not only a history, it also has recipes. And there's a sort of a joke to that, as we'll see it by the end of this conversation. Richard Foss has authored many articles on culinary history. He's involved with the Museum of the American Cocktail as its sort of West Coast impresario, and has most recently written Rum, A Global History. So, Richard, let's begin by discussing the physical and physiological constraints of cooking in the air. Some of these were human-imposed. Some of these are from nature itself. First of all, there's the danger of cooking beneath a bag of hydrogen.
Yes, that was the first problem that people had to deal with in the hydrogen balloon era. And it was something that was settled surprisingly quickly and using a set of techniques that are much older than you would expect. Of course, their concern was that they might, you know, you can set, have an open flame in a hydrogen balloon once, but that's about it because you're going to take the balloon down with you. But there was actually a mechanism that was first done, and I was shocked to discover this. It was actually discovered by medieval pilgrims so that when they were traveling by wagon, they could cook in the back of a wagon. And what they did was they were cooking without flame using the chemical reactions from adding water to quicklime. Mm-hmm. And that chemical reaction produced enough heat to either reheat something, like if you had cooked something the night before and wanted to reheat it, you could do so, or to simmer something. It doesn't produce a real hot flame, but it does produce enough heat to actually do cooking. And in the 1820s, that started being the standard method of cooking aboard balloons. And as for the reason why someone would need to do that, I might mention that, first of all, if you go up in a balloon, there is no heating system, and when you're going up to 5,000-6,000 feet, it's very, very cold. They were doing studies very, very early about people's physiology in flight because this was just something they knew that people could go to 5,000 feet. They had climbed mountains. They'd been up in the Andes and the Alps and various other places, but they didn't know what it would be like and how it would change your body to have that suddenly happen. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that they did, for instance, like the early explorers who were going up, the early balloonists who were going up and taking with them a variety of different animals, dogs, cats, birds, and intently studying them all just to see what happened, to see if one of them would be the canary in the coal mine, as it were, more affected than the others. Mm-hmm. So there was a whole adventure in this sometimes semi-scientific, sometimes scientific question of what we can eat in flight and how we're going to cook it. Because when you're up there in that cold balloon basket, boy, did you want hot food. And they started out with picnics, but this is before the invention of even proper anything that was going to give them proper insulation for a long period of time. And it's important that when they went up, they had no idea when or where they might come down.
Yeah. We'll get to that in just a second. I think you touched on another.
I wandered away from the physiology here, didn't I?
Sorry, a little bit. But you touched on another point, which I, it's actually of great concern to every airline flight that's taking off right now, and that's weight.
Yes.
Pilots measure their fuel not by gallons, but by pounds. They measure it by weight, and everything is meticulously weighed in order to know what the plane can handle. And, of course, that was a concern from the very beginning of balloon flight as well.
Yes, it's one of the reasons that some of the people who went up in the early days didn't bother to take their crockery back down. They just threw it overboard. And this is in the era before disposable plates that were meant to be disposable. But if you're up there and you're worried about not having enough gas to make it back to dry land when you're over water, everything's disposable. So
now,
in terms of weight.
Now, things change as people fly higher and higher. So we're moving ahead into the 20th century here. But of course, when you start to cook at 5,000 feet, even in a plane, of course, without quicklime, when you don't have a hydrogen bag, you still don't really want open flame in an airplane.
No.
So what do they transition to?
Well, they tried a number of different things. The first transition was actually between the balloons and Zeppelins, mm-hmm. because of the fact that the Zeppelins, being both directable and having an engine on board and being in the era of electric generators, they had the ability to generate electric power, and they gradually got confident enough that they were generating, by 1920, they were generating electric power to operate coffee makers and electric stoves. They basically had to invent the world's first all-aluminum kitchen, which they did because of the fact that both the lightness of aluminum and the importance of being unable to strike a spark off of aluminum, even if you want to. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about sparks if you're in an all-electric kitchen with all aluminum utensils. Mm-hmm. So the Zeppelins allowed a very high level of cooking. They considered their competition to be cruise ships.
Yeah.
So they were really giving you a cruise ship level type of experience as close as they can. They were flying with a wine cellar with hundreds of bottles. They were really going all out to match cruise ships.
Yeah.
And they did some stunts that no later aircraft was going to be able to do. For instance, at one point while traveling across the Atlantic, they saw a fishing boat, came down, basically dropped a rope down to the fishing boat, and had the fishing boat tie some fish to it so that they could have fresh fish aboard a Zeppelin going across the Atlantic. Try that on a 747. Yeah. This was travel for the elite, who expected food that would be of their quality. If they were aristocrats, whether aristocrats by birth or aristocrats of money.
Yeah.
So they demanded that. When you fast forward to the air age, and you might think, well, your aircraft in the air age had engines. Well, they certainly did have gasoline engines, but the problem with it was, since all of the power of those engines was needed to keep the aircraft in flight, they didn't want to divert power. It would be a shame if you crashed into a mountain because of the fact that somebody flipped on the coffee maker and blew the circuit. That wouldn't be a problem in a Zeppelin because of the fact that the giant engines aboard a Zeppelin, where it had vastly more power than was necessary, whereas a lot of the early airliners were relatively underpowered and had to struggle. They had to go through mountain passes in the Rockies rather than over them, mm-hmm. because they just didn't have enough power to go over them. Mm-hmm. So in the early era of fixed-wing flight, you were basically taking a picnic lunch and a thermos full of coffee,
yeah.
and that was all you had. And I might mention, the Zeppelins and the early aircraft, typically, when traveling, even transatlantic, were going at only between 500 and 1,000 feet.
Yeah.
So you didn't have some of the physiological effects that you have to deal with of the human body in flight. When you get up to 5,000 feet, your air is much more dry. So, I mean, you still have humidity at 1,000 feet that you don't have at 5,000 feet. Well, the humidity makes your senses more acute. You are much more able to smell something easily in a humid atmosphere than in a very, very dry atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get to aircraft that are flying higher, You have the problem that a meal would be perfectly tasty at ground level tastes flat and dull. You've lost any kind of floral flavors that are the kind of thing that make good wine or good tea or a lot of different meals. You start eating with your eyes and your nose. You enjoy the sight of that food and you enjoy the scent of that food. Well, aloft you have some perfectly beautiful meals, but once you're above 5,000 feet, it's very difficult to smell them and it's very difficult to enjoy them.
So that's the problem. That's the physiology of taste in the jet age.
Yes, the physiology of taste. It doesn't become a problem until the jet age because the propeller aircraft, well, for one thing, even the ones that could fly higher mostly didn't because we're before the era of radio navigation. We're in the era where pilots had to navigate visually, so they had to run their route around visual clues on the ground and stay relatively low so they could see them.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the... You mentioned, of course, in the period of the Zeppelins, the people who are on board are aristocrats, and it struck me very forcibly reading your book. How aristocratic dining in the air has been for most of its history, and that gets to a interesting. I think that explains a lot about modern airline food, actually, and we'll get to that eventually. But the balloon food, as you said, was aristocratic food. I mean, the people who are in the balloons eat what they would be eating if they're having a picnic on their estate.
Yes, it was inconceivable to go for one of those people to go up for a balloon flight without bringing champagne, brandy. Well, we're talking about a more bibulous era of society in general. As you go back through history, you see that people going back to the 1700s, sometimes you'd be horrified by reading a story of someone who, drank two or three bottles of wine at lunch, finished out with some brandy and port, and then put on his white wig and went back to the bench to judge cases.
Yeah. Now, the bottles were smaller, but still.
But still, yes. You have this general thing of there was not merely an acceptable level of drinking, but an expected level of drinking in that period of time. And some of it was because of the fact that they believed, rightly in most cases, that water was poisonous.
Yeah.
So you mixed your water with alcohol or you drank alcohol, man, woman, and child. So the act of drinking alcohol in flight, even though, yes, we now know that people who are flying really shouldn't be drinking much because of the fact that it helps dehydrate you when you're already in a dehydrating situation. But they didn't know that. To them, alcohol was alcohol and cigars were health food in that era.
Well, yeah, it's what a wonderful era. But the amounts that they ate are just classic. This is you're describing the flight of September 9th, 1836, of a balloon called the Royal Vauxhall. Nine people, and you write, dined on 40 pounds of ham, beef, and tongue, 45 pounds of fowls and preserves, 40 pounds of sugar, bread, and biscuits, and 2 gallons each of sherry, port, and brandy. And they also had hot coffee.
Now, I mentioned something, which is that remember that when that balloon was launched, they regarded it as a serious possibility that they might land in the wilds of Russia. Uh-huh. And they had brought enough food so that if they had a couple of days before being rescued, they had it. As it happened, apparently, they just had an absolute orgy of dining while they were up there. But they probably still had plenty of it left when they came down to the ground. This was that aspect of, there was plenty of Europe that was unexplored. There were parts of Europe that were still forested wilderness, which, right. If you float over Europe now, it seems inconceivable that so few lifetimes ago, we were talking about a place that was so sparsely inhabited. Mm-hmm. But it was. So you always brought much, much more than you needed and then just enjoyed life while you were at it. It was an exhilarating experience.
Yeah, it seems part of the exhilaration, the bravado of flying was to do something as natural as eating and drinking. Here's Alberto Santos Dumont, who, at least from his pictures, is not exactly, doesn't appear to be a gourmand of any kind. But even he ate roast beef, chicken, ice cream, cake, champagne, and drank champagne and chartreuse as he was beetling around the skies of Paris in one of his dirigibles.
Well, one of the things about Santos Dumont. Santos Dumont was what is an interesting character in history. He was actually a Brazilian rubber and sugar magnate whose passion was flight, and he moved over to Paris. And as you, I've noted from looking at the picture, he's a very small man. He is a slight fellow.
Yeah.
But for one thing, that was great for someone in his period of time and in his profession because of the fact that a bigger person would have spent less time up in those balloons. As you said, every ounce counted, and people who in other times would be jockeys or something similar are your ideal Zeppelin pilots.
The Wright brothers don't have a lot of surplus flesh on them, if you take a look.
When you get to the, there's a picture that I also have in there of Jack Sanderson, who was the very first airline steward, and he was someone who had basically stopped growing when he was about 12 years old.
Yeah.
He was a very, very small person, and one of the reasons that the first airline hired him was partly out of the idea that passengers who were scared of flying would look and say, hey, if kid can do it, I can.
Yeah. So there's this bravado to eating in the clouds. The Zeppelin is completely...
era of gentlemen adventurers.
Yeah, absolutely.
This was the era of people who were trying to climb Mount Everest and who were bringing along all kinds of odd things. It's delightful.
Yeah. And there's definitely, it's an aristocratic flight is a high class. It's an aristocratic pursuit. Therefore, the food is also of a matching status. You've said the Zeppelins are able to compete with the cruise liners. To recap again, people are bringing along their own food. They're bringing along their own thermoses of coffee or tea or whatever. But eventually, Pan American gets in the game and decides that they are going to compete with the cruise ships too. So how do they do it?
Well, Pan American worked with the Boeing company and came up with the first aircraft that had real flying kitchens aboard that were functional to cook in. Those were built by the Boeing company. I'll mention the Sikorsky company had put up aircraft with primitive, they were flying boats with primitive kitchens, but this was something that, it was the Boeing and Martin aircraft that were the real luxury giants of the sky. And it was felt safer to divert power from the engines to these kitchens because of the fact that when you're flying over water and you're in a flying boat, you can land anywhere. If something goes wrong, glide on down and fire up the radio and get someone to come out and help you. So it was regarded at first that aircraft flying over water were much safer. And this was also something to notice was that in a lot of the world, the air age arrived during the Stone Age. There were a lot of places that aircraft were going where you had no reliable electricity, no reliable power. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the aircraft that were flying up and down the rivers of China, the rivers in Africa, the Nile, they would land in the evening to refuel, and they would cook while down in the water. They would wait until the aircraft had landed and then fire up the kitchen. So in the early era, a lot of aircraft just stopped for meals. And you would stop and either stop and cook on a flying boat or on land-based aircraft. Every stop all the way across the country, and there might be a dozen of them, they would have meals available at the airport so that everybody could get off the aircraft. And while the aircraft was being serviced, everyone would troop into the hangar for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, whatever it was.
Yeah, I see Eastern would stop at Richmond in order to give them a Southern meal on picnic tables.
Yes. And Eastern, all of the Eastern Airlines flights up and down the coast had a stop in Richmond, whether or not anyone wanted to get off in Richmond, because that's where lunch was.
Uh-huh.
And it was a way that even in this relatively early era, airlines started reflecting their culture. Mm-hmm. And this is an element of it. People tend to think of food in flight, if they think about it at all, as a technological challenge. But it is also a challenge to match people's physiology when the chef who is cooking this is not, both is nowhere near the diners. I refer to this as, you know, this is the longest distance from the kitchen to the dining room in human history.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that it's, some of it is vertical. You have a meal that is eaten away from the kitchen by people who have altered senses. And the chef has to make their best guess about how it's going to taste to the people who are actually consuming it. Mm-hmm. And it's also the psychology of food, especially in the early era, when business people, politicians, movie stars started traveling. A lot of these people, these were not the adventurers. These are not people who were willingly flying. These are people who had to and probably didn't want to. And one of the most comforting things is to keep you from just staring out the window at how far you have to fall. A distraction, a very welcome distraction, is your dinner, your lunch, your dinner. It's a way of bringing a sense of normality to this very abnormal situation of being in a metal tube hurtling through the air.
And that becomes even more pronounced in some ways, at least the idea of distraction and also of mirroring certain comforting aspects of life on the ground once we get into the jet age. How do people, I mean, for one thing, many more people are flying after the Second World War than flew prior to it. It's still, I wouldn't call it democratic. We'll get to that in a bit, but there's a lot more people flying. How do things transition?
Well, the airlines became more mass transportation than they had been after World War II, partly because of the fact that so many aircraft had been built for the war that became surplus after the war and were converted to airliners. And there were so many aircraft and all of these new airlines and all of these individuals who had traveled during the war and who basically had sort of gotten the bug for traveling. And they were not afraid of flying at the very time when flying was much cheaper than it had been. And as a result, there was an explosion of new airlines, most of which didn't stay in business for very long. They were competing against better financed and more experienced carriers, and especially internationally, they were competing against government-owned or sponsored carriers. The U.S. effectively had one, which was Pan Am, although it wasn't officially a government-sponsored airline. In practice, they had all different types of subsidies, mail subsidies and things like that. The subsidies were the passengers were, in some cases, almost a nuisance. They needed the passengers aboard, but they got as much money from mail during some periods as they did from the passenger experience. So there were more people flying for a lower price, and that democratization, the aircraft became larger and larger, and the only way of competing, this was a restricted market, the prices were set by the government, so the only way of competing was via the food. Mm-hmm. United Airlines had been doing that even before World War II, and they'd been doing it because they made a very, very bad decision. They bought a whole bunch of aircraft that the Boeing company assured them were the perfect airplane of the future, something called the Boeing 247. And a couple of months later, something called the DC-3 came out that was larger, faster, cheaper to operate, and United had spent all their money on Boeing 247s. So United had smaller, slower aircraft. Nobody wanted to fly them, and in desperation, they decided to improve the food. And this was something that other carriers dealt with over time, which was when you're losing market share for some reason, start improving your food, start talking about it, start marketing using the food as part of the travel experience. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of the old airline posters that show TWA was particularly adept at creating airline posters that were gorgeous. And in some cases, quite interestingly, they actually use classical themes in their promotion. There's one of the ones that I found that is a picture of a stewardess holding all of these plates in an airline aisle with food behind her. And I looked at it and I thought, I've seen that image before. And I found an image of the Roman goddess Pomona, goddess of the harvest. Uh-huh. And you can practically superimpose one on top of the other. They had gone for a very classical image of this woman who is surrounded by abundant food. It's just that one of them was wearing a stewardess uniform.
With the national carriers, their national prestige is at work, but also they're reflecting their own culture in some way, or at least trying to how one perceives their culture. I mean, I don't know if Virgin still does this, but as recently as 10 years ago, they were serving you tea at like 30 minutes before you land or something like that, or serve an afternoon tea and so on.
Yes. A lot of the carriers, Virgin Atlantic is one of the ones that still, or at least the last time I flew them, still took great pride in the quality and in some cases the quirkiness of their food. They used to have some very beautiful little salt and pepper shakers that had emblazoned on them, stolen from Virgin Atlantic, because right. They knew you were going to steal them, so they might as well just make it so that you were doing advertising for them. We're jumping ahead a bit to the unfortunate era after the quality of food went down. But for a long time, the airlines really competed with each other. This is before the era of frequent flyer programs. Nowadays, I would venture to say that when you take any long flight, one of the first questions you're going to ask is, can I get mileage? Because I'm already getting mileage from my credit card and nine other different things. And, I occasionally get miles by actually flying miles. So people nowadays regard each trip as a way to add to their frequent flyer program, whereas in that era, you took the carrier that either had the amenities that interested you the most or that had the most direct route.
Yeah. So it struck me that what people were looking for up until, I guess, the 70s was the best possible experience going to that destination.
Yes.
It was much more like taking a cruise than anything else.
Yes, it was. And it remained that way for a long. It remained that way for a long time, into the jet age. Even as travel democratized and as the price fell, one of the things, if you look at a table, and you can find this on the internet, of the price of a flight between Los Angeles and New York, as expressed in the number of hours someone would have to work at the average wage.
Right.
And that has dropped like a rock. It used to be a situation where someone had to work for a couple of weeks at the average wage in order to afford a ticket. And nowadays, at the average wage, I mean, at the minimum wage in the United States, you can afford a round-trip ticket from Los Angeles to New York with basically a week's work.
Yeah.
So it has become much more democratic. It has become much more accessible to everyone. It has put bus services out of business because it's cheaper to fly once you factor in the cost of food and even the most minimal lodging.
Yeah. And, of course, what that also led to was basically airline food is at the end of airline food and endless complaints, woe is me's. I can remember as a very little child flying from Philadelphia to Chicago, which I do now, and I barely notice it. It's an hour and a half. And yet we were served Philadelphia snapper soup, because obviously United was going from Philadelphia. They had to serve something of Philadelphia. It's quite extraordinary when you think about it. And that was probably a three-course meal being served in an hour and a half.
And the carriers used to have, as I mentioned at one point in the book, the airlines used to serve at least a drink and a snack on flights of as little as a half an hour.
Yeah.
And it was, again, it was all part of the marketing. And there was a change that only happened after the deregulation period of the late 70s, early 80s, where the airlines basically started competing on price. And if you're competing on price rather than experience, and if you have frequent flyer programs that make people less likely to switch, then the airlines suddenly, their incentives absolutely reverse. They go from wanting to give you the best possible experience to actually wanting to downgrade your experience so that you will fly them first class or so that you will upgrade.
Yeah.
So we have now where, yes, you're having to pay for food. You have to pay for all kinds of things that used to be free.
Right.
You're paying for food. You're paying for, even in some carriers have started charging for hand luggage.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And this induces a certain whiplash amongst people probably who are older than 40. Because
that
what we mean. Yeah, right, and myself as well, who are still have our heads back in the day when all travel in the air was closer in a weird way to the early balloonists. It was a higher status. It was an experience. It was an adventure. And now it's like taking the bus, and we can't quite get over that.
Yes, it's the people who grew up in the era in which all travel was measured against, say, Southwest Airlines.
Yeah.
Not that I have anything against Southwest Airlines, because for what they do, they're fantastic. If you are doing short commuter hops any place, I mean, they have a great business model. And it works very, very well, but it is not a high service level business model. But then again, if you really look at it, how could you give the old standard of service aboard a modern aircraft? Because the modern aircraft are so much larger, and the ratio of servers, the ratio of cabin crew to passengers is so much different. In the Zeppelin era, you had a cabin crew, a crew person for basically one-to-one with a passenger. You had one crew member for every two passengers. You had really personalized service in that era.
Yeah.
In the later period, just post-World War II, most of your passenger aircraft were still in the 30 to 50 passenger range. And a couple of crew people going through their propeller aircraft, the flight is much longer, they can stop and talk to every person. They know your name. Mm-hmm. With modern aircraft, you would have to have what would seem like a small army of crew people to really give the kind of service that was common of 40 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you have a couple chapters on food and space after we've gotten through the collapse of airline food, and I can see why you have to do that. It's very jarring though, because the story hasn't yet started, or it's just started about food and space. But what struck me was the intimate tie-in between the consumer culture of the '60s and '70s, as consumer culture really got big and going. And space food. In fact, a lot of space food actually was never really in space.
Well, let me venture a couple of things, one of which is space at that period of time was the next frontier. Space was the romantic dream that America had lost for a while. We had lost our sense of a frontier as our country infilled, and psychologically, we still psychologically worshiped the idea of exploration and a frontier, even as we didn't have it even vicariously. But once we started sending people into space, there was a sense of we're doing bold things again. And people on Earth started basically using marketing more than they were marketing foods designed for consumption on Earth more than they were really marketing foods designed for consumption in space.
Mm-hmm.
It's about marketing. And there were some of the things. I mean, there are some elements of food in space that we do use. We still use freeze-dried food, for instance,
mm-hmm.
which, while it was originally developed by the Incas, it was commercialized for the space program.
I discovered that the genius of William Mitchell, the inventor not just of Tang, but Cool Whip, instant Jell-O, and Pop Rocks.
Yes. Don't you wish you could have gone to his house for dinner sometime? What an experience that must have been.
Think of all the things that never made it commercially.
Yes.
That he would have tried on.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
It is terrifying, right. Exactly. Some people probably didn't survive. But it's just extraordinary. I had not heard of, I knew that freeze-dried ice cream was never really used in space. I did not know that it was developed by the Whirlpool Company.
This is one of those things. The Whirlpool Corporation, there used to be a lot of corporations that had some experimental level of food science. And Whirlpool Corporation, there's a logic behind this. A company that made refrigerators was interested in promoting food that used refrigeration. They were looking for more and more ways of innovating in food sciences. And I guess they may have started out with promoting refrigerated food and just kind of wandered into other things.
Yeah. And then they went back, fortunately. I did never heard of space food sticks, which seems to be...
Really?
No, I never heard of them.
That's amazing, because they were the precursor to all energy bars. And in the 1960s, that was a real hip thing to have in your school lunch, was some space food sticks.
Yeah, I missed out on that.
They look like big Tootsie Rolls, and they had about the same consistency. Huh. And that made sense for traveling in space, because of the fact that the main problem they had in space is if you bit into a piece of bread or a cookie or a cracker, that would send little bits of crumbs floating around in the space capsule, eventually to get sucked into your air system and clog up the air filter.
Yeah,
needed things that were chewy and tasty.
Yeah.
And space food sticks, I remember them. They were chewy and rather aromatic. And the chocolate ones, they made some chocolate ones that had a kind of a chocolate and fruit aspects to them that were actually rather an attractive idea. They were energy bars.
They are the first energy bars, and you can see the connection to the space program and to modern ideas of fitness and exercise and travel and all the rest of it. The crumbs, it reminds me of your story of John Young and the corned beef sandwich. Can you tell that quickly as we come to a close?
Certainly. John Young knew what space food was like. This was a period of time in which they were drinking pureed spaghetti through a tube. They had dehydrated mashed potatoes that were rehydrated and served cold, so it's cold mashed potatoes. And he decided to smuggle a corned beef sandwich from Wolfie's Delicatessen inside his suit. And now this is one of those things where there's some people that people don't forbid because of the fact that it never occurs to them that any idiot would do them in the first place. And this is kind of in that general thing. Nobody was patting him down for, are you smuggling food in your spacesuit? Because what idiot would do that? Well, this is someone who was a kind of a notorious practical joker. He took a corned beef sandwich up there, bit into it, it started falling to pieces. And as it happened, the whole world was listening to this experiment because of the fact that, well, the world was tuning into these broadcasts from space. And they found themselves with no idea of what was really going on, listening to a pair of astronauts talking about eating a corned beef sandwich in space. And I don't have the exact dialogue in front of me, but it was silly. And it was something where there were two people who were having a brave and entirely unauthorized experiment up in space, trying to eat naturalistically.
Yeah.
Which is something that we now are much better at. The meals that people are eating now in space actually are appetizing. A couple of years ago when there was a launch that was around Thanksgiving and the people, they were talking to people up in the space station, people in mission control were eating bad, cheap Thanksgiving dinners, and the people in space were eating better. And it's the first time that the people eating cold leftovers were on the ground, and the people who were eating hot and appetizing food were in space.
Well, as we conclude, the theme of this series, which is food on the go, I believe.
Yes.
Is that things change? Food changes as it's traveled, or its foods are specially designed for travel. And that's...
Might I put it that humans who are given different environments, we must eat, we must drink, we must breathe. And of all of the things that we do, the one that gives us the greatest aesthetic joy is dining.
Yeah.
So anytime humans are in any situation for any period of time, we figure out a way to dine the best we possibly can.
Yeah.
And there are challenges in this, and those challenges are interesting. And the way that different people at different times confront those challenges says a lot about who people are and who humanity are.
I think that that's very nice. It also, as you introduce the recipe section, you say that this is a bit of a joke. I have to find, now I have to get to the right page. You say to include recipes in a book on this topic invites some ridicule because since people first started eating in flight, the meals have replicated what was made on the ground.
Yes. You don't, people tend to want comfort food. Psychologically, they want comfort. They don't want daring food because I think they might be afraid that if there is someone daring in the kitchen, there might be their brother with the same attitude up in the cockpit. Yeah. And you do not want daring people flying the aircraft. We want comfort food when we're in flight. We are slightly nervous and adrenalized, even the most experienced airline passenger. Their body is still giving them a little sense of you're in a confined space. Yeah. You are not truly comfortable. So we want to have comfort food. We have less of an appetite for unusual items.
Mm-hmm. And we want things that evoke either where we're going or where we've been.
Yes. Yes. Air France, starting in right after World War II, when Air France resumed service over the Atlantic, they started out with the idea of start experiencing France from the moment you leave New York, which was their gateway transatlantic at that time. So there's always been that sense of cultural pride that is reflected even after the era in which most carriers are explicitly owned and operated by governments. Mm-hmm.
My guest today has been Richard Foss. He is the...
I would like to mention that there's a website at Air Food History that has lots of pictures that didn't fit in the book. So if you go to airfoodhistory.com, you can enjoy a look at some of the things from yesteryear and some exploration of some things that didn't make it in the book.
All right, we'll certainly include that in the show notes. The book is Food in the Air and Space. There'll be a link to it on the website. Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambon. Talk to you next week.